welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration will be The Influence of Race in History by Dr. Gustave Le Bon, and it was first published in the Revue Scientifique on April 28, 1888. Historical studies are undergoing in our day a profound transformation. From being almost exclusively literary but a few years ago, they are tending to become almost exclusively scientific today. From the reading room of the literature, they are crossing over into the laboratory of the scientist. It is not only the progress of modern-day archaeology that has given new vigour to our learnings and ideas in history. The discoveries realised in the physical and natural sciences have contributed even more. It is thanks to them that the notion of natural causes is becoming imbued more and more in history, and we are getting used to considering historical phenomena as being subject to laws that are just as invariable as the ones that guide the course of the stars or the transformations of the body. The role that all the historians of old has attributed for so long to providence or to chance is today only attributed to natural laws, as entirely withdrawn from the action of chance as from the will of the gods. Certain of these laws govern chemical combinations and the attraction of matter. Likewise, it is other of these laws which govern thoughts, the actions of men, as well as the birth and waning of beliefs and empires. These laws of the mental and moral world, we often disregard them, but we are never able to elude them. They operate sometimes for us, sometimes against us, justly noted an eminent historian, but always the same, and without taking heed of us. Rather, it is we who need to take heed of them. Above all, though, it is the progress of the natural sciences that is responsible for the ideas that are beginning to be assimilated more and more in history. They are the ones which, having brought to light the totally preponderant influence of the past on the evolution of living beings, show us that it is the past of societies that one ought to first study in order to understand their present state and ascertain their future. Just as the naturalist today discovers the explanation of living beings in the study of their ancestral forms, likewise the philosopher who desires to understand the origin of our ideas, institutions, and beliefs must first study their earlier forms. Envisaged in this way, history, the interest in which will seem very weak when it restricts itself to the enumeration of dynasties and battles, acquires today an immense interest. Of all the sciences, it is bound to be the foremost one, because it is the synthesis of all the others. The sciences that we usually devote ourselves to direct us to figure out and decipher a substance, an animal, or a plant. By contrast, history teaches us to decipher humanity and permits us to understand it. Indeed, the human spirit cannot propose any higher and more useful pursuit than this. The method that the modern-day scientist applies today to history is identical to the one that the naturalist employs in his laboratory. A society can be considered like an organism that is undergoing development. There is a social embryology, just like there is an animal or plant embryology, and the laws of evolution that regulate them are of the same order. Animal embryology, in going back step by step in time in the ladder of existence, proves that our earliest ancestors are more closely related to lower animals than to ourselves, and allows us to see how each of our organs has emerged by slow transformations, chosen by selection and accumulated by heredity from a much coarser organ. We know how the fin of the amphibian became the membrane that sustained in the air the pterodactyl, then the wing of the bird, next the paw of the mammal, and finally, the hand of man. Social embryology, or to employ a simpler term, the study of civilizations, shows us 1. the series of the progressions in which the marvellous and complicated mechanism of civilized societies makes its way from the savage state where for a long time mankind maintained itself, and two, how our ideas, sentiments, institutions, and beliefs have their roots in the earliest ages of humanity. Instead of observing how formerly an abyss existed between peoples who ate their aged parents and those who waste their attentions on their old, crying on their tombs, between peoples who regarded women as lower animals belonging to all members of the tribe, and those who have enwrapped them in a chivalrous cult, between those who put to death all their deformed children, and those who lodge in magnificent asylums, the idiots and the incurable. I shall focus on the tight bonds which across the ages have united the most different ideas, institutions, and beliefs. We will discover that today's civilizations have sprung from past civilizations and contain the germ of all civilizations to come. The evolution of ideas, religion, industry, and the arts, in a word, of all the elements which enter into the makeup of a civilization, is just as regular and inevitable as the one comprising the diverse forms of an animal series. The factors which determine the birth and development of the basic elements of a civilization are just as numerous as those which govern the development of a living being. Their study has hardly begun today. Indeed, one will search in vain for the presence of such a study in most history books. It is nevertheless possible to place in evidence the influence of several of these factors. Among them, one of the most important, perhaps the most important because it represents the synthesis of all the others, is race. That is to say, the ensemble of the physical, moral, and intellectual qualities which characterize a people. It is exclusively to the study of its influence that this present paper is being dedicated. At the moment when the races of mankind first appeared in history, they had in general already acquired fairly stable qualities, which could only be transformed very slowly afterwards. The oldest Egyptian bas-reliefs upon which are found reproduced the diverse peoples which the pharaohs were in touch with show us that our present-day large classifications of races may already be applicable to the dawn of history. Human races, or to speak in a perhaps more scientific language, the diverse human species which live on the surface of the globe, took shape over the hundreds of thousands of years that have preceded historical times. They undoubtedly formed themselves, like all animal species, by means of slow changes produced by natural selection, hereditary accumulations, and the variability of the environment and habitat. But if we understand the general laws of this slow evolution, we only know the details, a matter which we shall not, moreover, occupy ourselves with here. Taking the wholly formed races, my aim in this paper is to demonstrate the immense importance that the moral and intellectual qualities of the races under the sway of a civilization play in its development. In order to understand the history of peoples, the genesis of their institutions, their morality, and beliefs, it is their mental constitution that is necessary for one to first study. It is in vain for us to ask of anatomical characteristics, as we have done for a long time, for the means to differentiate races. The colour of the skin or hair, as well as the shape or volume of the skull, only provide us with very rough divisions. Psychology alone permits us to clearly specify the differences that exist between diverse races. It shows us that peoples whose mental constitution is similar will have similar destinies when they are placed in analogous circumstances, even though they might differ very much by their exterior aspect. It is thus that we rightly are able to compare the modern-day English to the ancient Romans. Indeed, there exists an obvious relationship in the mental constitution of these two peoples, same indomitable energy of character, same respect of their institutions, and same disposition to change them slowly and unjoltingly, and the same ability to conquer peoples and maintain colonies. From the point of view of the exterior type, there is, on the other hand, a complete dissimilarity between the Roman, with his stocky, robust shape, vigorous and short profile, bronze skin, dark eyes and hair, and the Anglo-Saxon with his tall, elongated figure, white skin, light-coloured eyes and blonde hair. In waiting for the era, probably far into the future, where the progress of the study of the brain will have revealed to us the cerebral differences corresponding to the diverse modes of feeling and thinking, we ought to restrict ourselves to differentiating peoples only by their psychological qualities. The two fundamental psychological elements that it is always necessary to study in a people are character and intelligence. From the standpoint of the success of a race in the world, character possesses an infinitely greater importance than that of intelligence. Ancient Rome, in its decline, most assuredly possessed more superior minds than the Rome of the early ages of the Republic. Brilliant artists, eloquent orators, clever writers appeared here by the hundreds. But what it did not have were men of virile and energetic character, undoubtedly little mindful of the refinements of the mind, but who were very mindful of the city whose grandeur they had established. When its citizens lost these qualities, Rome was obliged to cede its place to much less intelligent, though much more energetic, peoples. The conquest of the old Greco-Latin world, refined and lettered by semi-barbaric Arab tribes, constitutes another example of the same kind. History, moreover, is full of such examples, and the future, no doubt, will present others. From the point of view of the historical development of a people, its character plays a superior role to that of its intelligence. From the point of view of the level of the civilization, it is, on the contrary, intelligence which is the predominant factor. However, the action of this latter only exercises itself on the condition that it is not merely assimilative, but rather is creative. Peoples who are only endowed with an assimilative intelligence, such as the Phoenicians of old, the Mughals much later, and the Russians of our day, may more or less appropriate for themselves a foreign civilization, but they cannot make it progress. It is to the peoples endowed with creative intelligence, such as the Greeks of antiquity and the Arabs of the Middle Ages, that we owe all the general progress that the whole of mankind has profited from, even though the warlike conquests have little benefited but a single people. It is, in fact, solely to the development of creative intelligence, that is to say, to associate ideas, to perceive their remote analogies and differences, that we owe all the significant discoveries that have been made. It was this faculty that permitted Newton to discover that the falling down to the ground of an apple was a phenomenon of the same kind as the gravitation of a celestial body, as well as Franklin to recognize the analogy between an electric spark and lightning. The most superficial observation demonstrates very quickly that the diverse individuals who make up a race differ one from the other by their physical aspect, as well as by their moral and intellectual constitution. But a little more attentive observation soon shows that under these apparent diversities lurk an ensemble of characteristics common to all the individuals of this race. Characteristics as stable as the vertebrae in the vertebrates, the ensemble of which constitutes what justly can be called the national character of a people. Whenever we speak of an Englishman, Japanese, or a Negro, we immediately attribute to him, and most often without being mistaken very much, an ensemble of general traits that are precisely a kind of condensation of the characteristics of his race. In acting in this manner, we unconsciously proceed like the naturalist who describes an animal species. If it is a question of a dog or a horse, for example, the characteristics chosen by him will be sufficiently general in order to be applicable to all the possible breeds of dogs or horses, whether it's a matter of a bulldog or a mongrel, a fine racehorse, or a heavy plough horse. These national characteristics created in homogeneous peoples by the long-time continuous influence of the same milieu, same institutions, and same beliefs, plays an entirely fundamental role, although invisible, in the life of peoples. They represent the past of an entire race, the result of the experiences and actions of a whole long series of ancestors. Each individual who comes to life brings this heritage with him. During his entire existence, the past life of his ancestors, like a formidable weight, lies heavily upon all his actions. His character, that is to say, the ensemble of sentiments which guides him in life, is in reality the voice of his ancestors. This voice of the dead is all-powerful, and whenever it finds itself in opposition with the voice of reason, it is the former which invariably triumphs. The part played by the past is infinitely large, whereas that of the milieu operating over a short duration of one's existence is infinitely small, as is well said in the following by the poet Daniel Lesueur. For the past in man in his present subsists, and the deep voice which rises up from the tombs dictates an implacable order which no one resists. There are human races that are like animal species. Some present many varieties, while others, on the other hand, offer very few. The fewer varieties a race presents, or if one prefers, the fewer varieties it has that deviate from an average type, the more the race is homogeneous. Such is the present-day English, a blend of the ancient Breton, Saxon, and Norman, who effaced themselves in forming an absolutely new and completely determined type. If, on the other hand, groups are juxtaposed without having been sufficiently interbred, the race remains heterogeneous, and the average type becomes more difficult to establish because the common traits that comprise it are less numerous. In France, for example, the Provençal is quite different from the Picard, as is the Auvergnat from the Burgundian. However, if there does not exist yet an average type in France, there at least exist average types of certain regions. Unfortunately, these types are very distinct by character and the ideas that they hold. Consequently, it is difficult to find institutions which are able to suit them all. Our profound divergence of beliefs and sentiments, and the political upheavals that are the consequences, owe themselves mainly to existing differences in mental constitution that only the future will perhaps be able to erase. It is easy to understand that the more a race is homogeneous, the more it will possess common ideas and sentiments, and consequently, the more it will be energetic and called upon to march rapidly on the road of progress. On the other hand, where the ideas, traditions, beliefs, and interests remain distinct, dissensions will be frequent, and progress will always be very slow, if not completely impeded. No other idea is more fantastical than the one of bringing under the same governmental yoke extremely different races. Even when chains are used on such peoples, the government will only succeed for an instant in imposing its rule. The history of great empires formed by dissimilar peoples will always be identical. The ones of Alexander and Charlemagne, for example, came apart when the powerful hand of their founder had ceased holding together the pieces. Among the modern nations, only the Dutch and the English have succeeded in imposing their rule over Asiatic peoples very different from them. Moreover, they have succeeded only because they are wise enough to respect the customs, morals, laws of these people, leaving them in reality to administer themselves and limit their role to touching one part of the taxes, engaging in commerce, and maintaining the peace. One sees by what has proceeded how it is important to study the composition of a people in order to explain its history. One also sees that the word people cannot in any case be regarded as being synonymous with race. An empire, people, or state, this is a more or less considerable number of persons brought together by the same political and geographical necessities and subject to the same institutions and laws. These persons may belong to the same race, but they may also belong to very different races. If these races are very dissimilar, no blending is possible. They may, in an extremely strict sense, live side by side like the Hindus in India, who are subject to the Europeans, but one should not dream of providing them common institutions. All great empires that unite dissimilar peoples can only be created by force and are condemned to perish by violence. The only ones that are able to last a long time are those that are formed slowly by the gradual mixing of little differing races. Races which constantly crossbreed amongst themselves, live on the same soil, submit to the action of the same climate, and possess the same institutions and beliefs. These diverse races may then, at the end of several centuries, form a new, entirely homogeneous race. As mankind grows older, races become more and more stable, and their transformations by way of intermixing become more and more rare. In prehistoric times, when man had a shorter hereditary past and possessed neither fixed institutions nor very certain conditions of existence, the environment had a much more profound action on him than it does today. Civilization has permitted man in large part to escape from the influence of the environment, but not to that of the past. The more humanity ages, the heavier the weight of heredity becomes. It is such today that heredity alone can struggle against heredity. It can in reality only dissociate by repeated crossbreedings the fixed characteristics in a race by placing in opposition to it contrary characteristics. In order that in the intermixing of two races, heredity is able to act, it is first necessary that one of them is not too numerically smaller to the other. It is then necessary that these two races do not possess a much different mental or physical constitution. The first of these two conditions is totally fundamental. Whenever two different races come face to face, the more numerous rapidly absorb the other. For example, living in the midst of a black population, some white families will disappear in a few generations without leaving any traces. This fate has been the one of all conquerors who were strong in weaponry but weak in number. The only ones who have escaped this rapid disappearance, like the Aryans of old India and English today also in India, established a rigid caste system that prevented the crossbreeding of the vanquishers with the vanquished. The caste system having been the exception, the general rule one observes is that with the passage of a small number of generations, the conquering people are absorbed by the conquered people. It will not disappear, though, without having left civilizing traces behind. For example, Egypt, conquered by the Arabs, absorbed very rapidly its conquerors, but the latter left behind them the most important elements of a civilization: the religion, language, and arts. An analogous phenomenon has happened in Europe among the peoples called Latins. The French, Italians, and Spaniards do not have, in reality, any trace of Latin blood in their veins, but the institutions of the Romans were so strong, their organization so powerful, and civilizing influence so great, that the countries occupied by them over several centuries have remained Latin by the language, institutions, and spirit, which to them is especially suitable. It is not, moreover, because it is the strongest that a people imposes its civilization on another. Very often it is the vanquished who impose its own upon the conqueror. The Franks ended up overcoming Gallo-Roman society, but they were soon morally conquered by it. They were physically conquered before long as well, because they plunged themselves in the midst of a population much more numerous than them. This conquest of the vanquishers by the vanquished can also be observed to a much higher degree again in the Muslim peoples. It was precisely at the time that the political powers of the Arabs had completely disappeared that their religion, language, and arts spread out more and more. There are 50 million Muslims today in India, 20 million in China, and in a slow but sure way they will end up being in Africa, the civilizers of the large, mysterious continent. Whenever races are placed face to face by the happenstance of an invasion or conquest are too dissimilar, there will not be, as I have earlier pointed out, any bondage able to blend them. The only result that can occur is the extermination of the weaker race. Conquered for centuries, Ireland has never been submissive, and its population decreases each day. For entirely inferior peoples, the destruction is much more rapid yet. There are races, such as the Tasmanians, where one is unaware of more than a single representative, and it will soon be the same with the American Indians. All inferior people placed in constant contact with a superior people are condemned to perish. It is always by means of systematic and bloody extermination that an inferior people will disappear upon contact with a superior people. The simple action of presence, in order to employ a chemical term, is sufficient to bring about the destruction. As soon as the superior people establishes itself in a barbarous land, with its complicated mode of existence and its numerous means of subsistence, it will monopolize and subdue all the living forces of the country with much more rapidity and ease than the former occupants. These latter, formerly masters of all the land's resources, end up being reduced to laboriously grubbing up the tiny leavings of the conquerors, and they find themselves in such conditions of inferiority that they die of hunger if they are not decimated by sword or the vices that the Europeans brought them, vices which constitute nearly all that they are able to borrow from complicated civilizations which the abyss of heredity separates them from. The methodical massacres of Indians had pretty near ceased in North America, and yet the Redskins continued to recede and diminish before the white race. Submissive to hereditary influences that had grown too heavy to allow them to transform themselves, they only knew and wished to live for hunting. Now their old hunting grounds, secured, cleared, and cultivated by the Anglo-Saxons, no longer offered them the resources they formerly did. In vain, fields and houses were given to them, for they lodged their horses inside the houses, while they themselves continued to live in their tents, as had their fathers, and allowed themselves to die, rather than put on the plough, the hand that only knew how to wield weapons. And we will leave that here for today and continue in the next episode.